throughout March and April, my plan is to focus on Genesis. Genesis is not only the first book of the Bible, but it is like the foundation of what it means to know God. If you're going to know the most basic features about who God is and what God has done, you have to know Genesis. You have to understand it. It is the foundation to the house. About a month ago, we studied the flood in Genesis 6 through 9, and we learned very soberly that God is humanity's judge, and God has no obligation to save anyone, but he, in grace, often provides a narrow way. That was the ark, and there is still the narrow way of committing your life to Christ. After the flood in Genesis 9:1, God commanded Noah and his wife and his three sons and their wives, everyone who got off the ark, God commanded them, I'm quoting Genesis 9:1, be fruitful, multiply, and fill the earth. That is a repeated command. God had given that command to Adam and Eve in Genesis 1. Be fruitful, multiply, fill the earth. God's design from the beginning, both at Adam and Eve and both at those who came off the ark. His design has been all along that image bearers fill the earth, that people made in God's image, made to reflect God's order, his ingenuity, his beauty, his love, his goodness, image bearers of God, go throughout the earth, fill the earth, and reflect God, glorify God by developing creation and culture in a way that reflects his beauty and love. That's been God's design. Now we're going to read how the earth gets filled. Genesis 10. These are the generations of the sons of Noah, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Sons were born to them after the flood. The sons of Japheth. What follows are 14 descendants of Japheth. I'm not going to read all the names. I will read some of the names in the chapter. Note verse 5. From these, the coastland peoples spread in their lands, each with his own language by their clans in their nations. Now, it's generally agreed that the ark, when it says it rested in the mountains of Ararat, the ark rested somewhere in Turkey. And the post-flood human cultures then spread from that point on earth. When it says these coastlands peoples spread, it's very likely, it's actually about half of the names in this chapter are identifiable in terms of regions of the world. It's very likely that what's being described is that the ark rested somewhere in this area and Japheth went to this region, Turkey and Greece and Italy and Spain are all, according to the Mediterranean Sea, coastlands. What the author notes here is that these different regions were populated by people of different languages, of different ethnicities, and of different nations or political structures, that people of different kinds are filling this coastlands region. And these are the children of Japheth, or the descendants of Japheth. Then verse 6 is going to start with the sons of Ham. And you may remember from Genesis 9 that it was Ham's son Canaan who was cursed for some kind of wicked behavior. The sons of Ham are Cush, Egypt, Put, and Canaan. There he is. The sons of Cush, Seba, Havilah, Sabta, Ramah, and Sabtica. The sons of Ramah, Sheba, and Dedan. Cush fathered Nimrod. He was the first on earth to be a mighty man. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore, it said, like Nimrod, a mighty hunter before the Lord. It was proverbial. He was noteworthy as a tyrant. The beginning of his kingdom was Babel, Erech, Akkad, Calneh, in the land of Shinar. And from that land he went into Assyria and built Nineveh, Rehoboth-ir, Calah, and Rezin between Nineveh and Calah. That is the great city. What's being described here is Nimrod is one of the first national leaders who, through tyranny or violence, consolidated power and then began expanding his power. The world has been full of tyrannical governmental leaders since. Most nations throughout history, and most nations still today, are led by power-hungry and money-hungry tyrants who resort to violence against other peoples and against their own peoples for power and for money and reputation. This here, the fact that Nimrod is part of human history, shows again that the flood did nothing to change human nature. The historian then describes how the descendants of Ham moved into modern Israel and Africa. This is where Ham. So Japheth is here. Ham then moves into these regions. Verse 13, Egypt fathered Ludim, Anamim, Lehabim, Nephtuhim, Pathrushim, Casluhim, from whom the Philistines came, and Kaphtorim. Canaan fathered Sidon, his firstborn, and Heth, and the Jebusites, the Amorites, the Girgashites, the Hivites, the Arkites, the Sinites, the Arvadites, the Zemarites, the Hamathites. Afterward, the clans of the Canaanites dispersed, and the territory of the Canaanites extended from Sidon in the direction of Gerar, as far as Gaza, and in the direction of Sodom, Gomorrah, Adma, Zeboim, as far as Lasha. These are the sons of Ham by their clans, languages, lands, and nations. The author here lists 30 descendants of Ham, and you actually might note some of them. The ones especially mentioned in verses 16 and 17 are well known because they're going to be conquered by Joshua in the conquest, or by David when he sets up his throne in Jerusalem. He's going to have to take out the Jebusites. When Joshua goes into Canaan and David goes into Jerusalem, he is fulfilling the curse that God spoke to Ham's son Canaan. Then the author shifts from outlining the descendants of Japheth and of Ham to the third of Noah's sons, Shem, in verse 21. The father of all the children of Eber, the elder brother of Japheth, the children were born. And he's going to then list 26 descendants of Shem who dominantly migrated to this region. Shem is going to migrate especially to the Arabian Peninsula and up into Iran and Iraq. Included among Shem's descendants is verse 25, a man named Peleg. His name means divided, and it's explained in the verse why he was given the name divided. It's because in his days the earth was divided, and you might scratch your head and say, what? What does that mean? We're about to find out. Notice in verse 31, here's how the descendants of Shem are summarized, and then the descendants of all of Noah's sons are summarized. It says, verse 31, these are the sons of Shem by their clans, languages, lands, and nations. That same phrase is used of all three genealogies. Then the big summary, verse 32, these are the clans of the sons of Noah, according to their genealogies in their nations. And from these, the nations spread abroad on earth after the flood. In general, here's a visual of what's described in Genesis 10. You have the sons of Noah going out from the single region, filling the earth. If you do the math, the author seems to go out of his way to list 70 descendants. 14 from Japheth, 30 from Ham, 26 from Shem. There are 70. This is a Hebrew way of communicating symbolically that God's concern is for all the nations. After chapter 10, you actually might think, well, humanity is doing a pretty good job of doing what God commanded. He had commanded them to fill and to spread out among the earth. But that's not what happened. Humanity didn't do it until it was forced to, until God compelled humanity to spread. Chapter 11 actually begins with a flashback to what happened in Peleg's day that forced Japheth's and Ham's and Shem's descendants to go out. Chapter 11, verse 1. Now the whole earth had one language and the same words. And as people migrated from the east, they found a plain in the land of Shinar and settled there. And they said to one another, come, let's make bricks and burn them thoroughly. And they had brick for stone and bitumen for mortar. Then they said, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens, and let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. And the Lord came down to see the city and the tower, which the children of man had built. And the Lord said, behold, they're one people, they all have one language, and this is only the beginning of what they will do. Nothing that they propose to do will now be impossible for them. Come, let's go down there and confuse their language so that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord dispersed them from there over the face of all the earth, and they left off building the city. Therefore, its name was called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth. It's actually likely that this was the Hebrews' term for the city. The Babylonians' term for the city is Babel, and it seems that the Hebrew name was Babel. The Babylonian word means something like, this is the gate of the gods, and the Hebrew word means confusion. And from there, the Lord dispersed them over the face of all the earth. Verses 10 through 26 then spell out the genealogical record, the whole record from Noah, his son Shem, down to Abram, who's going to become one of the most significant figures in human history. If you total up the dates between Shem and Peleg, you get a figure of about a century. It seems that there was about a century between the flood and Babel, the Tower of Babel. And I just think we should get our feet wet in the next section so you see how it connects, and then I'm going to just go right for the jugular and preach, okay? Verse 27 starts dabbling into the next chapter of Genesis. Now these are the generations of Terah. Terah fathered Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Haran fathered Lot. Haran died in the presence of his father Terah, in the land of his kindred, in Ur of the Chaldeans, that's modern-day Iraq. And Abram and Nahor took wives. The name of Abram's wife was Sarai. Jump to verse 30. Sarai was barren. She had no child. Terah took basically his family, end of the verse, and they went forth from Ur the Chaldeans to go into the land of Canaan. But when they came to Haran, they settled there, and the days of Terah were 205 years, and Terah, this is Abram's father, died in Haran. Now the Lord said to Abram, go from your country and your kindred and your father's house to the land that I will show you. And I'll make of you a great nation. I'll bless you. I'll make your name great so that you will be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. And in you, all the families of the earth shall be blessed. All the families of the earth. Where did those come from? They were described in Genesis 10 and 11. Genesis 10 and 11 is setting us up, really, for Genesis 12. And God's plan to bless all peoples on earth. If you ask, what is the main point of Genesis 10:1 through 12:3 that we just read? The main point is this. God splits rebellious humanity into many nations in order to bless them all. God splits rebellious humanity into many nations in order to bless them all. The three parts of the passage we just read explain, like chapter 10, God's focus is on all nations. Chapter 11 explains how there came to be many nations and languages. And chapter 12 then explains how God is going to bless the peoples of every nation. What I want to do is just go from here and just say, this is what it means for us. God is a God of many nations. He created many nations. What do these chapters mean for us? First is this. We should always focus like God on all the nations. Chapter 10 focuses on the whole of humanity, and it teaches most basically, it teaches that God's focus is on the nations. The nations were God's idea. Some people get the idea that the Old Testament is all Israel-focused. And God was really prejudiced. He didn't care about other nations. That is so not true. If you get Genesis 10, 11, and 12 rightly, you understand that God was focused on Israel to bless the other nations. He was focused on Israel because he was more broadly focused on all of the nations. God's focus has always been on all people everywhere. His burden has been that all of humanity fill the earth and display his glory, that all of humanity reflects his order, his beauty, and his love. And Genesis 10 communicates this so powerfully. You might be tempted to think, I don't know, I won't ask for a raise of hands, but how many of you, as I read Genesis 10, were like, this is worthless. This chapter, like, what in the world does this have to do with me? All of these, like, strange names and places that I've never heard of and I don't care about. What in the world is going on here? Genesis 10, if you want to know how it applies to you, just right at the beginning of Genesis 10, God is focused on the nations. I should be too. That's the message. If you're going to reflect God, you're going to have a heart for the nations. So I ask, do you pray for people of Saudi Arabia? Is Saudi Arabia on your heart? Is it even on your radar? What about the people of Turkey or Sudan? Are the nations on your heart like they are on God's? Do you pray for the gospel's advance among the Mexicans? Or are you just concerned that that wall gets built and they stop making signs bilingual in America? Is your heart like God's on the nations? Do you make fun of Greece for going bankrupt? Or do you pray that God's glory is manifest in Greece? Is your heart right now concerned about God's glory being manifest in Iran and in North Korea? Is your heart burdened like God's for his glory to be reflected in all nations? Genesis 10 should teach you God's focus is on all nations. Mine should be too. Let me encourage you, if you want to grow in your focus on all nations, sign up at Frontline Missions for their monthly persecution updates, or sign up at operationworld.org for their daily prayer emails that give the top burdens for countries of the world that you may have never heard of. Frontline Missions persecution update every month, Operation World's daily prayer emails. They will help you to keep the nations in front of you. We want our hearts to reflect God's. As we grow in godliness, we will grow in world focus, in world burden. Second, we should remember our corruption and God's gracious judgment whenever we get frustrated by the confusion of the nations. Whenever we are confronted with the confusion in our world today, it should remind us first of our problem and then of God's gracious judgment. Our world today is a confused mess. We are billions of people speaking thousands of languages, living in hundreds of countries, and it's difficult sometimes to know exactly how many countries there are and there are not, because certain countries are folding or assimilating or dying, and other countries are splitting and springing up. It's confusing when you look at the languages and the nations and so forth. How did we get here? Genesis 11, 1 through 9 teaches us. Babel, this ancient city, somewhere in modern Iraq, was built by Nimrod, this tyrannically violent man who consolidated power. If you say, I need to understand Babel, I've only understood it like as a kid's story. What really is going on here? Look at chapter 11, verse 4. Here's what the people said, and it's horrible. They say, come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower with its top in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. There are three bad desires expressed in that statement. The first bad desire, they want to build a city centered around a tower reaching into the skies. I think it's probably different from what most of you heard in Sunday school, from what I heard in Sunday school. If you grew up in Sunday school, you might have been told that the people were trying to build a way into heaven, a stairway into heaven, a building that went to God. They were trying to build their own way to God. That's not what's going on. The great sin of Babel is not that people were trying to get to God. The great sin at Babel is that people were trying to be God themselves and ignore God. In all likelihood, this was a massive ancient temple called a ziggurat. Some of these ziggurats were 300 feet high. To stand on the top of them would have made most of us afraid. If you're afraid of heights like me, you would have not wanted to go up to the top. It would have been a place where this civilization essentially invented their own religion. So the first bad desire is essentially one of idolatry. We don't need God. We're going to invent our own religion. It's idolatry. The second bad desire there expressed in verse 4 is that the people wanted to make a name for themselves. Rather than filling the earth with the glory of God's name, they want to park in this place of earth and make their own names great. They supposed that they were great. This is the sin of pride. I want people to know how great I am. The third bad desire is there at the end of verse 4. They say, let's do this, lest we be dispersed over the face of the whole earth. That's the sin of outright defiance. God had told them repeatedly, multiply and fill, spread yourselves throughout the earth. And they said, in effect, let's directly disobey God. We're not going to follow God's agenda. We're going to make up our own. So you have humanity here at Babel united in idolatry, pride, and defiance. Two professors, Andreas Kostenberger and Peter O'Brien, say, by the time we arrive at Genesis 11, we've reached the lowest point of human existence. This is a fractured, disastrously broken society that has lost any sense of God-centeredness. That's the problem with human society, is not centered on God. Verse 5 then, after these three bad desires expressed in verse 4, verse 5 says, humorously, God came down to see what was going on. He didn't come up to their tower. He came down to check out what was going on. Verse 6 describes his concern. He says, this is only the beginning of what they're going to do. Nothing now that they propose will be impossible for them. On initial reading, you might scratch your head and say, doesn't God like human ingenuity and inventiveness? God's concern here is not with human ingenuity. His concern is with human implosion. He's concerned about the future of humanity. If this is what they're doing, not 100 years after the flood, what are things going to look like in another century? These people are going to self-destruct. He knows that if this violent, godless selfish culture keeps going on in its unitedness against God, it will self-destruct. And so to delay humans and their self-destruction, he splits their culture. It's exactly what your financial advisor does if you're part of a mutual fund. You don't put all of your eggs in one basket, so that if one of the companies you're invested in tanks, you still have a relatively stable portfolio. Could you imagine if a leader like Joseph Stalin governed the world? What would happen if Pol Pot was a world dictator, not just Cambodia's dictator? Within the past generation, a quarter of Cambodians were massacred. And yet, most of us in here say, I just found out about that in history class. It didn't even touch your world here in America. God diversified the world so that all of the expressions of self-centeredness and violence and power-hungry leaders who lead to famines in their country affects relatively small portions of the population, not the entire world population. That's what happened at Babel. God diversified, if you will. This was extremely gracious judgment. So now I just come back to the main point. What do you think when you have trouble in your college class finding a good translation of Dostoevsky that you can understand? What do you think when you're watching the images of a system of immigration that's been broken for decades? What do you think about when you call to get your computer serviced and someone from India picks up and you can't understand them? When you are confronted with the confused mess of our world today, you should say, humans have a problem. We're corrupt. We're idolatrous, proud, and defiant. And God split us up like this to keep from self-implosion. Third point, we should know that the hope for every nation is in Abram's seed, his offspring. According to Genesis 11 and 12, God split the world into many peoples and nations in order to bless people of many nations. He split people up at Babel so he could bless people through Abram. That's how Genesis 11 and 12 fit. And this now, Genesis 12, starts what we might say is the rest of the story of the Bible. The story of the Bible is that God created the world good. He created people to fill the world with images of his beauty, love, and order. But when given the choice, humanity chose treasonous anarchy. That's what Adam and Eve committed in the garden. They defied God, and they plunged the whole human race in God defiance, and its consequence, death. Yet, rather than justly destroying humanity and condemning it, God, in grace, said, I want to show the glories of my love. I am going to bless these wicked, defiant, idolatrous, proud people. And he does it through Abram's descendants. He does it through Jesus. The whole Old Testament is going to describe the history of Abram's offspring. And it is a mostly bittersweet story until you get to Jesus. And Jesus' life is bittersweet, but it's mostly sweet. Jesus lives the perfect life that not one of Abraham's descendants, not one of the kings of Israel ever lived. He lived perfectly. And then in love, this king says, I'm going to give my life as a ransom for many. And he, the perfect king, lays his life down. He dies as the lamb, as the sacrifice for sinners. The New Testament, the very first verse of the New Testament says, in effect, here's Abram's descendant. Jesus, the son of Abraham, is the first verse of the New Testament. Here he is, Abram's descendant, the one through whom all the nations are going to be blessed. It's what we've been awaiting the entire Old Testament. And then the New Testament explains not only who that king is and how he died as the lamb and how he rose again as the great king, but the New Testament describes how that message gets broadcast, it gets published and proclaimed to people of every nation in the book of Acts, like we studied last year. And the New Testament is going to end, just like Aaron read this morning. The New Testament ends saying, people from every nation and language and ethnicity are going to be praising the Lamb. What you get in Genesis 12 is the solution to humanity's problem. God is going to bless all peoples through Abram's offspring specifically. As time goes on, we find out that this is none other than King Jesus, the Lamb of God, who was crucified for sinners, so that if you will trust in him, if you'll commit your life to him, he'll forgive you, cleanse you, change your heart. I urge you to commit your life to Jesus if you've not. If this is new to you, keep on asking questions, keep on reading scripture, keep on figuring out who is Jesus. Is this account trustworthy? Keep on asking and answering these questions. I urge you, no matter what your background, no matter what your ethnicity, commit your life to Jesus. He is the blessing. He is the one through whom God is going to bless all nations. Now, what we're about to do is observe the Lord's Supper. And I just want to say that what we do at the Lord's Supper is actually a little foretaste. That this prophecy that I'm going to bless people of every nation, it's already begun to be fulfilled. Who are gathered together today? Some of us have German backgrounds. Some of us have Italian backgrounds. We've got people in here who are Russian, and other people who are very proudly Slovenian. We've got some people in here who are Jewish, and other people who are Indian in your background. What's brought us together? Well, one of the things that's brought us together is that we live in the melting pot of America. Our country's been quite open to immigrants, like my great-grandmother who immigrated from Russia. But much more what brings us together is not some American melting pot. What brings us together is our conviction that Jesus is the King who was crucified for us. We've committed our lives to him. He's begun to change us. That change has taken place from the inside out. We're no longer the people we were before we met Christ. We've committed our lives to Jesus. And so you've got Russian Americans and Italian Americans and German Americans and British Americans all gathered around a table saying, my life is committed to the Lamb. See, the prophecy has begun to be fulfilled. Here at the table, we are evidencing that Jesus is the blessing. He is the one who can change the human heart. He is the one who can unify again people of every nation and language.